Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Motormouth podcast with me, Tim Sylvie. Today on the show, we have another person from the F1 paddock. We have Ruth Buscombe, who is an F1 strategist, a job that I completely oversimplified and slightly overlooked until I dive deeper into it with Ruth. It's a massively, massively complex role, both at the track, at the factory, and everywhere in between. It was a fascinating conversation. She's clearly got a very big academic brain, and I had to focus bloody hard to keep up with it, but I think I just about managed. Brilliant chat. Let's head over and hear from Ruth now. Enjoy the show. Remember to subscribe, follow, review. It really makes a difference. And enjoy the show. Ruth, welcome to the Motormouth podcast. Now, we like to go back and look a little bit about what's shaped our guests, how their formative years might have affected their path. Take us back to the early days, childhood. And what was life like as a child? Where did you grow up? What shaped you as an individual?
So I grew up in the East End of London, proper East Ender. I enjoyed football. That was my sport growing up when I was a kid. My dad was more of a Formula One fan and he was bigger, so he had the remote. Kind of football and Formula One. Fortunately, I'm a West Ham fan. So
I was going to ask.
99% of the audience, but I did grow up in the East End of London, so it was that was really the only choice.
Yeah, you're a bit stuffed there. You haven't really got a huge amount of choice. I'm a Spurs fan, so we won't dive into a fight off on football terms. But West Ham are doing all right these days. I mean, it's going all right.
Yeah, at the time when I was growing up in the East End of London, you kind of had to pick a secondary team in like the North London Derby because Hammers were so bad. So like your kind of backup team was Arsenal. So still staying away from the Blues.
So bringing it back to Formula One. So at what point does motorsport come on your radar? Was it a passion or something you fell into a little bit later on after the football subsided?
I mean, I think in terms of, I can't really remember life before Formula One. So it was always on the television. My dad was always very excited by it. Growing up in a kind of McLaren household, that was pretty much it. So it was always there. I would say, I think I was about 9 or 10 when I worked out that I could do maths and Formula One, and then kind of working out that the kind of people on TV that were sat on the pit wall stands were engineers, and that you could do that and you could blend sports and maths, which was the thing I was best at. That was kind of it, really. I was doomed from that point onwards.
So if you hadn't gone into the motorsport world, do you think it would have involved something to do with academia or maths in another industry, perhaps?
I mean, I think I was just very stubborn. So I don't think I really had a plan B, I think. but yeah, I always kind of thought like in the multiverse, there's like another Ruth working in NASA, in the mission control in NASA, because it's kind of a bit like race strategy. So I did actually study aerospace and aerothermal engineering.
Yeah.
And never used it. So that would have, that, like, I'm hoping there's one multiverse where we use those 4 years of Cambridge.
So I went to Cambridge the other day to the theatre to see a live show with Professor Brian Cox. And it felt like a maths lecture. And I had no idea what he was talking about. But I'm sure it's all fascinating and clever stuff. But it's big brain thinking, that, isn't it? I can't quite get my head around all this, you know, space exploration and what else is out there. Is that something that floats your boat, all of that stuff?
Yeah, you know, if you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you've got to first invent the universe, basically. So yeah, no, it's, I do find all the maths and stuff like that kind of fascinating. But I do like the sports element. So I think I've always been obsessed with sports. So that's kind of where motorsport edged out, you know, the kind of, I think I'm, you know, about 50 years too young to do a space race. So once that was sorted, maybe Mars in 50 years time.
Yeah, who knows?
But, I think if there's no racing, it's lacking in something.
Well, fortunately, there is racing, and we're here to talk about race strategy and being a race strategist. Can you break it down for us? How do you define it? If there's a layman listening to this that's perhaps new to Formula One, how do you define being a race strategist? What is it?
So being a race strategist is a kind of global headline, is facilitating the best possible decision making across a race weekend. Now, breaking that down in terms of what does that actually mean we do, it means we help decide and do the kind of the analysis and put together all the information from various different sources, even outside of strategy. So how the tyres perform, information from how the car's performing, both from our aero engineers, from our performance engineers, how's the driver performing, what's the driver's strengths, weaknesses, where are we in terms of overall performance, to try to work out within the scope of the rules, what's our best kind of plan of attack for the race weekend in terms of data collection, then in terms of planning, in terms of timings for qualifying, how many sets do you need to use to maximize your qualifying, given everybody's got the same number, but you can use more in earlier sessions, timings of that, how many number of laps you want to do, making sure you send out the car on time, just to get the lap in. That's an important one. And then of course, there's the kind of the compounds, that the main thing that people see on the race. So that's, you know, which combination, so which kind of different colours we want to use, and then which permutation, so which order we want to use them in. And then, of course, you've got things like rain, safety cars, VSCs and red flags. So it's basically putting together all the information to help making the decision from a lot of sources on what you want to do during a race.
It's a complicated role, isn't it? And it's more complex than I think a lot of people realise. How much of that strategy is done on the track versus in the pit lane, for example? You know, we see a lot of the stuff that we hear as fans is about undercuts and overcuts. And, you know, we sort of look at it in its simplest form, I suppose. But there's so many variables there that you mentioned. Is there sort of weighting you can put next to different elements of the role when you're actually live on the pit wall?
Yeah, definitely. And each track kind of has its own character, its own unique kind of combination of elements that make that track its own, like, individual, like a person. And the same thing with the tires, like they are very kind of like have individual characters as well in terms of like their dependability. So, you know, when it comes to a track, like, you know, we just had the race last weekend in Japan. The things that characterize that, when you say undercuts, is a bit like Bahrain, where we had a strong undercut. But unlike Bahrain, which is a really easy overtake, Suzuka has got a bit harder overtake. It's one of the more difficult tracks to pass. So therefore, track position and undercut, and also keeping an eye on the weather, makes a really big difference there, because the thing about that track surface is it puts a lot of energy in the tires. So if the temperature drops, suddenly you're actually putting way less energy into the tires. You've got some other tracks where it doesn't really matter. You've got other tracks where, you know, it really depends where you go as to what the kind of flavor is of the month or flavor is of the week.
So how do you look at a track and go, okay, this is likely to be, say you're going to a new circuit and you're like, this is likely to be a track that really is hard on the tires and hard on the car. This is going to be, you know, a high downforce track. How do you assess those different elements at a place you've never been before? Is that a challenging thing to do? Can you do it through simulations before you get there?
So in terms of how hard it is on the tires, in terms of pure energies, now that's relatively speaking, one of the easier things for teams to kind of work out, because we have correlated simulator models that have been correlated to real life. And you can get your track maps. There's a big company called R-Factor Pro that makes quite, they go out and physically scan the track. So you can kind of simulate a lap. And so you'll understand how much energy is going into the tires. And you'll hear maybe people talk about lateral, which is sideways, longitudinal, which is kind of braking straight, and then combination, which is a bit of both. You have a good idea going in of how much energy. Then in terms of the other thing you need to know, is the other part of the equation, is what's the track surface like? And this is something that when it's a new track, often that means you don't know until you physically get there. So the best way of seeing this is that, you know, in Qatar last year, which was effectively a completely new track because they'd resurfaced it, you suddenly see Lewis Hamilton out there on a scooter where normally he's not there, because actually seeing the track surface is kind of a missing piece. So you would physically scan it. So teams have effectively what is a fancy camera, to take fancy pictures of the track, bearing in mind it might not be the same all the way around on some tracks. And then that will work in combination with the sims to kind of try to predict the amount of energy that's going to go into the tire per lap. Now they'll also put things like kind of what car configuration you're in makes a difference there, how much downforce you're running, for example, how much fuel you've got in the car. And then of course, the kind of the external temperatures can make a difference. Now, what's harder to predict are kind of, let's say, side effects that you get. So things like graining, for example, which is incredibly non-linear. And it isn't something that, you know, people really have a simulation model for. So when we hit tracks like that, for example, I mean, people that really just watched Formula One won't remember that China is actually the poster boy for front graining. It is the most front limited track, I think, ever. I mean, I'm happy to be proven wrong. That's certainly the most front limited track we've kind of raced on in recent years. And so that one's all about front graining. So it's historically a lot harder to predict that, and even harder to predict rear graining. Same thing when we get blistering, same thing when we get extra kind of things where it's not really performing as it should. And that is about seeing what the conditions are like, comparing it to kind of other kind of historical data you have. And then of course, kind of feeding in live, saying and reacting to say, okay, is this graining going to change our race completely, or is it just surface level?
So you're looking at a lot of different data points before you go to a racetrack, whether it's an old track or a new track. I guess if you're going to an old track, you've got more data points to run simulations from. So when you're, before you go to a race circuit, your day-to-day in the factory, is that just sort of gathering research, running simulations, testing things out so that you get to a point where you arrive at the racetrack and you broadly, barring different scenarios that are happening in the racing, you kind of already know what your plan is?
Well, I think you've got to remember that we've got very limited testing time. So you're kind of trying to make the best plan. You kind of got to get it almost right from the beginning. So even if you had every single possible option, that would be, you'd need about 50 free practice sessions. So actually, even with knowing that, oh, okay, I go to Monza and it hasn't been a two stop, or it hasn't been a three stop in the last 50 years, helps you. There's still a combination of, oh, do I actually need that extra medium, or is it the soft? And like sometimes with the way that the choices go, for example, if you need to save two hard tires for the race, as we've seen some of the races recently, you have to make that decision before FP1. Because in FP1, you need to decide, am I going to put a medium on the tire? Am I going to put on a hard on the tire on Friday? So, and when it's gone, it's gone. So there is actually, even though you do have a, let's say, a kind of subset of answers, there's still enough scope to get it right or get it wrong without having to have the full complete menu, basically.
Now, when teams get this wrong, and I guess it's the strategist that this falls back on, when a team makes a strategy call during the race, the pressure must feel quite intense. But is that decision solely lying with people like yourself? Like, what's the sort of chain of command? Is there a process where you're, if something quick needs to happen, is it like, right, I'm making this call, that gets passed to the engineer and passed to the driver? How does that communication flow?
Every team will have a different kind of command structure. If you think about kind of like a military equivalent, you know, each different country has a different way, the way that they run their kind of like their army. But the most important thing is that within that defined structure, you follow it. So most teams will have a series of kind of OPROCs or kind of procedures that say, you know, in this team, the strategist is responsible for these decisions, X, Y, and Z. Normally you'll have a point where you'll say, if there's time to make a decision, you will check it with a higher up. If there isn't time, there's a cutoff point that's been defined at some point during that race weekend where you just pull the car in based on, and that person, maybe the strategist, most teams it's the strategist. Sometimes it could be maybe the head of engineering on the pit wall. It's kind of depending on how senior or experienced your strategist is or how you like to run your team. So the kind of the who's and the what's of how the kind of each of the decisions are structured is usually based on a series of trying to make it as bulletproof as possible with a lot of backups, but then also setting, you know, last call lines to make sure that the decision gets made, because across a season, the worst decision you can make is not making decisions. So if you see it in your head that every single lap, there is a decision to be made, there's stay out or there is go into the box. And there is no option to not make a decision, because if you not make a decision, you've said stay out, then suddenly it becomes like a beating drum. And every single lap you have to say, okay, by default, we're doing this or by default, we're doing that. And if it changes, this is the set point that we change it. Because if you kind of perceive it as don't make a decision, stay out or box, most of the time you kind of get eaten by the blinds, really, and then you end up doing something kind of really rubbish in the middle. And as a strategist, you're not really doing your job. You're kind of probably just having a very good view of the race if you sat there don't making any decisions during it. But it would be a good view.
Absolutely, it would be. And it's a high-pressure environment. Formula One is a high-pressure sport. For those who might be listening to this that are looking to start their career in Formula One and they're thinking perhaps engineering or race strategy is an area I'd like to get into. Obviously, you need a certain degree of academia and you need qualifications, I'd imagine. It's not one of those sorts of roles that you can kind of, you know, learn on the job, I would guess. But the other side of it is the human skills. With all that pressure, do you think there's a certain type of profile of individual that suits a race strategist more than others?
I think so. I mean, I think you have to enjoy the pressure of it. There's lots of really, really important roles within a Formula One team that are super critical to winning championships. The kind of the type of pressure you get is, you know, in terms of delivering projects that are over a 9-month period, you know, delivering an aero concept that is not in any way more, you know, less important than a strategy call decision. It's just a different kind of pressure and the way that the demands you are on as a person to kind of perform over kind of a long project decision, or whether it's kind of really detailed analysis of data and you've got to, like, you know, understand something over a week, or manufacturing, putting the car together is pressure in a very different point. You know, obviously if you put together a brake set wrong, the car stops on track. And it's just the same with strategy, really. So that live decision making is the joy of the job. So if you don't enjoy that part of the job, there's not really any point doing it, because that's the bit that, you know, most of us kind of live for, is the fact that kind of pressure is a privilege and actually getting to go out and do that. It's a bit like asking a basketball player if they prefer practice or basketball, like they actually like playing in the NBA, or, you know, you like playing in the Super Bowl. So I think that would be the thing that's the most thing, is that if you enjoyed the kind of sporting pressure of making life decisions, using mathematical and engineering and STEM skills. I think like the race strategist job or the countdown job where you have to do the maths really quickly is basically the one for you.
And how does somebody make their way into the sport initially? I mean, my inbox, as I'm sure yours is full of people going, how do I get into motorsport? How can I get my first step on the ladder? Because everyone that likes motorsport and wants to work in it, generally speaking, big generalization, but will want to be in Formula One. How can they start things off? What's going to get someone through the door when there are so many people competing for those very few spots?
Well, first off, you know, if you're able to get a a degree in a STEM subject. It varies a bit across the world. Obviously, in the UK, we have almost like a ranking where universities are kind of, some universities are more prestigious than others. So if you can get into one of those and get the best degree class possible, that would be the first and kind of foremost thing, which is kind of, you know, your kind of initial ticket to entry. Beyond that, you know, it's very difficult when you're a young person, especially if you're surrounded by people that have got, you know, maybe much more kind of like affluent backgrounds, or maybe they have somebody that's in the industry, to automatically discount yourself and to feel like, oh, it's impossible, I'm never going to have a chance because like my daddy doesn't have a garage where I can build a car in, or like, you know, my grandpa wasn't the CEO of this company. But actually, I think everything's moving more and more into the correct direction. And, you know, for me, I remember thinking when I was kind of first started at Cambridge that there's no chance I'd be able to get into Formula One because, you know, I'd never been able to have a chance to like build a car. And then Formula Student was there, and that was a really fantastic opportunity. It's called FSAE in countries outside of the UK, especially the US. And that is a completely free, kind of university program that runs against loads of other universities, where you build a car and you kind of build it to a certain number of specs, and you learn so much. And also the networking is fantastic, even if the car is rubbish, because our car was truly terrible. Everyone thought we were going to be amazing. So like, oh, Cambridge engineer. We were like Hesketh without Zandvoort. We were just truly awful. But we do have all 10 Formula One teams, and we had 3 manufacturers at one point in terms of our alumni. So that is essence to the fact that, just like Sebastian Vettel, it's not how you start. Doesn't matter if you get a penalty 9 seconds after the start of your Formula One career, it's how you finish.
Yeah, brilliant. It's funny talking to someone like you. I find intelligence so intimidating versus like celebrity, because it, people like you, we've had a few people on the show like you. In fact, Roddy Basso was on the show, who was at NASA for a while. We've had a few people with big brains. It's so interesting talking to people like yourself. I've had Nico Rosberg on this show. I felt less intimidated talking to him than I do to you, because you've got clearly such a big brain, and coming, you know, Cambridge grad, it's really impressive stuff. One thing I did want to touch on was inclusivity in motorsport, because we've had loads of really interesting women on this show, people from the LGBTQ+ communities as well. And we've talked at depth about what Formula One is doing to try and encourage more women to work in Formula One, not just in strategy or engineering, but, you know, it could be marketing or, I don't know, anything up and down the paddock. How have you, A, found being a woman working in what is still, I think, perceived, rightly or wrongly, probably wrongly, as a man's world? And are you seeing the right changes in the sport that's encouraging women to enter the sport? You know, got things like More Than Equal and the F1 Academy, obviously, now. But are we doing enough?
So short answer is probably mixed. I think we're kind of really, you know, starting in Formula One, where I did about 10 years ago. Over 10 years ago now, 12 years ago, time flies. It was a very different space to the space it is today. And I think we're kind of in an era where people kind of my age, maybe a bit older, a bit younger, could go through their entire Formula One careers and never experience any form of ism directed that way, their way, whether that was because of their gender, you know, background, race, who they love. I think there is also, unfortunately, the scenario that you can have a unilaterally awful experience, and that you can end up with a bit of a mixed one. And that's certainly been mine, is that effectively it comes down to a little bit of a lottery, in that you're kind of hoping that the kind of the established people, which, you know, at the moment tend to be of the demographic of kind of the senior management, the really guys at the top that are making decisions, are kind of your classical rich white males, that they are the right kind of rich white males that are going to be making those good decisions. And you can end up, you know, in really wonderful rooms and wonderful spaces, and have people make great decisions that, you know, and which is completely, you know, huge that people do that, because, you know, if you are making decisions about your company or your sport that don't serve necessarily you but serve other people, that is a really brave and great thing to do. So it shouldn't be taken lightly. But I think it's, you know, you can end up with bad experiences. And I think, you know, I think most people would still say that, you know, we've made a huge step. But, you know, there's still a huge step to go. you know, I always would like to be, for me, it would be great if kind of by the time I like pop my clogs and you see the kind of F1 team pictures at the beginning, the first race and the last race of the year, if you like kind of had a complete mix of humans in those photos, that would be like, that'd be a good little deathbed moment.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, I think, you know, Formula One is heading in the right direction. And it's also great to see, you know, I come from a commercial background. My background is sponsorship in Formula One. And for me, it's great to see brands like Charlotte Tilbury and ELF and Tommy Hilfiger aligning with F1 Academy. You know, that is very new. You know, there was, I think ELF, they're sponsoring an IndyCar team. Charlotte Tilbury have come in F1 Academy. It's just great to see these brands starting to make an impact and hit the headlines and helping change that landscape. Let's talk about the future of the sport. We've got some massive changes coming in 2026, and they've hit the headlines in the last sort of 24, 48 hours with some slightly concerning simulator results that are being aired, and various commentators have been speaking about it across social media with the active aero and some of the concerns that creates in their simulations. Should we be concerned as fans, the direction that Formula One's heading in 2026 and beyond? I guess ultimately, do you think F1 is heading in a good path?
I think you have to trust in it. I think if you look at the kind of growth of Formula One and what it has done as a sport, and if you look at some of the decisions that were made that people hated the idea of, for example, the halo, that everyone kind of said, oh, this is awful, you know, including quite a lot of the drivers. I think my favorite example is Kevin Magnussen, who was kind of really very bolshy about it. And then, you know, kids, a wife, and seeing his best friend's life being saved by it later in the Bahrain crash with Romain, suddenly he's changed his opinion, which is fantastic. And I think it's just about kind of being informed about kind of all of the kind of the goodness that can come out of these decisions. I think the other thing to bear in mind with 2026 is that, you know, in terms of aero development, there's an embargo, so teams can't actually start developing those. So you have to kind of take everything with a little grain of salt in that, you know, what's going on quite now, which is kind of almost the kind of the dance in the background, the political dance that goes on, is that teams will personally kind of lobby for regulations, Taylor's oldest time, it's been happening since the 1950s, that kind of move them in their direction where they think they can be strong. So that is also kind of a bit of kind of propaganda that could be going on. So I think in terms of, you know, there's absolutely, you know, the FAA and F1 will make sure that the regulations are safe. They know that that's the highest priority. So that's the first thing. Obviously, in terms of like active aero elements, the actual kind of the follow on for that, they've got a really smart team of people, you know, working within Formula One, working within the FAA, like some of the really, really top notch engineers now that I know personally that are working on those regulations. And I think it would probably be a disservice to them. And these are people that have built championship winning cars, you know, people like Tom Barsis, people like, you know, Ross is also obviously putting in input. You've got so many great names that are helping with these regulations that you just kind of got to have a bit of faith, wait and see. And of course, you know, we could be focusing on one element and suddenly it's something else completely. Like I remember when there was the big rate change ahead of 2014, everyone was saying that it was all going to be about fuel consumption. And there was all these things about, oh, people will have to save fuel for, like, you know, it'll be awful, the racing will be terrible. And then it just came down to straight horsepower. And in terms of, you know, the actual like ranking was just that one of the teams, manufacturers had built a rocket ship. So I think it's obviously fun to discuss and to have conversations about it, but I certainly wouldn't be worried. And I think the kind of the aims in terms of the roadmap of trying to create, you know, a sustainable, profitable, safe Formula One that, where you touched on it earlier, is kind of moving into that kind of four quadrant movie area, which I think is, that's the thing we should be really excited about, is that, you know, before Liberty took over, the average fan for a Formula One was a 52-year-old white male who lives in Burnsley, I think it was. And now the most recent, you know, study that came out is got the 40% of viewership is female. So we're not getting female brands advertising because they feel sorry. They're advertising because they can sell their product. And actually, if we can expand the kind of the scope of Formula One to make it something that is effectively, you know, a Marvel movie rather than like another one that's only you're only going to go to. If you look at kind of superhero movies, I think that's the best kind of story about how Marvel movies were made for a specific demographic, like kind of that style of like, you know, superhero movie that you would never think about going to with a family, let alone kind of having a you know, a group of young girls going to see it. And now suddenly it's a family genre. And that one is great for us because we all get to, you know, watch the films, but it's also great for the industry because it's now creating a lot more money. And I think if the second you see Formula One like that and go, actually, if you look at the content of the movies for the original demographic 20 years ago versus now, they're fantastic. They're getting more bang for their buck because the budget is bigger, the pie is bigger, it's more profitable. And I think it's the same thing with Formula One.
You've painted a very clear picture there. And it's encouraging to hear those thoughts, actually. Now, we have a final three questions, which we ask all of our guests. They're always the same questions. And they throw up a myriad of different answers. I'm going to fling them over to you now. The first one, what's got you excited at the moment? And it doesn't necessarily need to be motorsport related. It could be anything.
A Lewis to Ferrari in 2025.
Good answer. I think it's going to be fascinating to see. I've been talking about this a lot on social and for a lot of reasons, that the merits behind the move, you know, what's the motivation behind the move? Is it to get that eighth championship? Is it financial? Is it a bit of both? You know, is it driving for the iconic Ferrari? It's going to be fascinating to see how it all pans out. What's your personal take on it? Why do you think he's gone there?
Well, I'm biased because I was at Ferrari and I was a McLaren fan my entire life. And I only went to my Ferrari interview when I was at university as practice for my McLaren interview. And I went there and the magic juju happened. I fell in love with the place, fell in love with the people, the soul of it, kind of had a very tough interview. And then at the end I was offered, you know, food, which was like carbonara, pizza, ice cream, way to my heart. So that was a plus, but then got to go see the old race bays. And there is a magic in the air. In Ferrari. And of course, you know, I owe my career to Ferrari. So I understand that I maybe am biased. But I think it's incredibly special to have that kind of that representation in Ferrari in red and in Italy. I hope he wins. But even if he doesn't, I think it will be a fantastic kind of moment for motorsport.
Yeah, absolutely. Second one for you. What's one lesson your job has taught you that you think everyone should learn at some point in their life?
Oh, that's a really good one. I think it's about reframing failure. I think kind of not seeing failure as necessarily a bad thing in isolation and being open to kind of, there's a NASA term that kind of Chris Hadfield talks about in his book, which is kind of an astronaut's guide to life on Earth, about pulling at the strings of failure. And there's some really good examples in that in most strategists' lives, where if you kind of run from a failure and you try and like whisk it under the carpet, like it will come back and sting you. But actually, if you're kind of open and honest and embrace your failures and you're working in an environment that allows you to do that safely, you can then build on that, learn from that, and actually create tools or learning or understanding that will always pay you back 10 times fold over. And I think that's the kind of the main thing that I would say, is that, you know, you have to kind of treat kind of failure and success both as a little bit of a kind of imposter, and focus on kind of the journey and the decision making you make.
Final one for you. And this is an interesting one, and you can get as philosophical as you like or as completely shallow as you like. It's completely up to you. And I've actually tweaked this one from the notes that I sent over to you, because I did have on there, what item could you not live without? But that question was a hangover from a previous guest who I've had on the show before, so I couldn't ask him my usual third question. So I'm going to ask you the usual one, which is, what are you scared of?
What am I scared of? I think losing loved ones. Especially if you're stuck halfway across the world and you can't get back in time. I think that would be, I had a kind of really scary experience, unfortunately, on the way to Melbourne. Thankfully, yeah, my dad was okay. But I think that was the kind of the scariest thing, that, you know, as part of your job, you might miss those kind of those key moments, or you might get, I mean, I can't miss a birth of a child, but obviously men can. But, you know, things like that, I think, you know, generally, you know, loss of people that you love is the worst thing in the world, to be honest. But unfortunately, part of life.
Yeah, very good answer. And I actually relate to two of those things. So I had my second child, Hector, who's now six. I became self-employed a number of years ago, and being self-employed, you have to have certain commitments that you fulfill. Otherwise, you know, you lose the thing and you lose your money. And I got called to the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix to run a big program. I was really excited about it. And as I walked out the door, unbeknown to me, I was waving my wife and at the time my other son, Arthur, off. And she was starting her contractions as I was walking out the door, and I missed it. We had to do it over, it was Skype in those days. And I had to meet Hector via Skype, and I didn't see him until he was 10 days old because I was stuck out in Abu Dhabi. So that was one. And then I lost my dad at the beginning of this year, but fortunately I was there. I wasn't traveling at the time, and I was there for the whole week of his last week. And I can totally relate to that. I mean, losing people is horrible at the best of times. If you're halfway across the world, even worse. I completely agree. And thank God I was there for that week because it was extremely special. But two very good ways to sign off the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. It's fascinating talking to you and hearing all about the role. And I know that people will respond to this really well because we get so many messages about people wanting to work in motorsport. I think this will really help them on their way. So thank you for that. Ruth, thank you so much for coming on the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.